IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to today's episode of All Things Policy. In today's podcast, we will be having a discussion based on Lieutenant General Prakash Menon's article in the print that talks about the apolitical nature of the armed forces in India. So since post-independence times, particularly the Nehru government, as you have mentioned in your article, General Menon, there has been a persistent separatedness maintained between the armed forces and the political and bureaucratic institutions. Now, there exists the underlying question on how effectively this distinction can be maintained as the evolution of military-civilian relations is slowly facing a change. So, to talk about this, we have General Menon with us. So, welcome, General Menon.
Thank you.
So, the first question I want to ask you is quite simple, and it's also a bit complicated. So, with the changing governments and flexibility of the armed forces to work with these institutions, have they been able to maintain this apolitical nature, say, from the times of Nehru government till now, till the Modi government? So you mentioned in your article there's a conflict of interest between the protection of the apolitical value and personal ambitions that do not allow the military to be utilized for narrow, politically partisan acts of self-aggrandizement. So where do you see, how would you respond to the nature of the armed forces in dealing with, you know, different governments up until the present Modi government and along with this government too?
So the issue is that we have a constitutional framework which provides guidance for the relationship. And that constitutional framework makes the armed forces, really speaking, although it is symbolic, directly under the commander-in-chief, who is the president. So the supreme commander-in-chief of the armed forces is the president of India. And that symbolic status actually indicates what the relationship of the military is with the state. And therefore, the state is represented by the president, the military, along of obviously with the, which is an arm of executive, which is the government in power, have a relationship which is subordinate to civilian control. And that civilian control is exercised through the government in power. But ultimately, it is responsible through the commander-in-chief. So this particular distinction that you work under the government in power, but your ultimate responsibility lies with the commander in chief, therefore indicates the nature of that relationship that the military should have with a political party in power, which is that it remains subordinate as an executive arm. It has to, since everything is done in the name of the president, follow the orders given to it. But the question of relationship is about conforming to the constitutional values which the armed forces is expected to do. And those values tells us that the ultimate defender of India's democracy is the armed forces itself, who should be willing to sacrifice lives in the process of defending it. So, as we look at it historically, civilian control, as Nehru envisaged, was carried out in such a manner that it became a severe form of political bureaucratic control, which emasculated military effectiveness because it was too one-sided. Military's participation in decision-making was weak, And what has changed in recent times with the present government is the rectification of that by bringing about what has been talked for several decades, very deep defense reforms, which envisages the creation of the Department of Military Affairs in the MOD, the creation of a Chief of Defense Staff, and the mandate given to the Chief of Defense Staff to create theater commands. What this means is that the proximity of the military to the government in power is now not so distant as it was before. They are very much part of the government, because you have uniformed people, especially in the form of the CDS and the Department of Military Affairs, now part of the government. Previously, they were adjunct to the government. They were officers which were outside the department itself. Now, this is a department of the government. So, there is a major difference. The question is whether this closing up between the military and the civil, which this reform will bring about, how is it going to affect civil-military relations? And that is what I say. And I say this by saying that the jury is still out. Because when the reforms were undertaken, we are well aware that there is need for distance. But that distance in the previous configuration was impacting military effectiveness. So it was politically decided that we need to rectify it. But I don't think that the risk of the closeness between the military and the civil government can be dismissed. And why do I say it's a risk? I say it is a risk because that militaries, the Indian military, and the civil government in power could possibly cozy up in a relationship where the military is used by the politicians towards domestic partisan politics in their interests. And that is the danger which I flag in my article.
Yeah. But General Menon, you mentioned that this proximity between the government and the military is more evident now, and there is lesser distance between the two. So we see politicians bringing in the achievements of armed forces into political discourse and at election rallies and campaigns, as you also mentioned in your article. So I'm talking about like how Modi mentioned the Balakot strikes in 2019 in his election campaign, and they use the military achievements for their political gains in a way. So what does this imply for the continued separateness maintained between the two institutions? And is this a dangerous move? And it constitutes the interference of politicians in the military, and an area where they have to stay away to protect our democracy. So what do you think about this?
See, I think we have to understand that politicians will be politicians, and therefore you can't expect that they will have the same value systems of the military. I am saying that the only way that the military can withstand the pressures which politicians will build against it is only by having an ethical fiber which is different and stronger than that of civil society and politicians themselves. Unless that fiber is strong enough not to bend to political pressure, especially because of personal gains which might ensue by obeying certain orders which should be questioned and are not questioned, that is the ethical challenge for military leaders. It is not an easy challenge, because even when you get orders to do something, you have to make a judgment at the top as to whether those orders actually are against the very spirit of the Constitution itself. But whatever might be the misgiving, it should not be overlooked. Normally, it is settled by going and having a discussion behind closed doors with the leadership themselves, or putting the issue in writing and let the politician actually override it. And in my experience, I would say that most cases, when issues are put into writing and there is a logic there, the politicians normally do not like to override it. So the question eventually comes out to that the nature of Indian politics will go, in fact, they're going to get deeper, they're going to get more divisive, going to get more difficult. As a imagination of the future, Indian military will be more and more challenged. We should be prepared to be more and more challenged by this constant efforts of politicians to use the army for domestic politics. Because politicization finally has to be weighed, as far as the military is concerned, in the balance of domestic politics. So the only thing which withstanding as a bulwark of resistance or against how you fight it is the ethical fiber. That's what I say in my article, of the military leadership. There's nothing else, because it's only a question of whether, even when they disagree, what is the nature and how serious is it? Does it warrant a protest in writing behind closed doors and even a resignation? That is a decision which has to be taken. So these are issues which are belonging to the ethical domain, and what it means is this is the domain of the moral compass of military leaders.
Yeah. I want to highlight the importance of the Chief of Defense Staff and the Chiefs and Commander of Theaters in ensuring that politics and military don't mix together. So you say in your article that the example set by senior military leadership can, to a significant extent, determine the ethical texture of the military's relations with politics in India. So do you see any differences in commitment to a role, such a prestigious role like this, from earlier times to now? And have these senior military officers and commanders been able to preserve the values bound to them, that they are bound to by the Constitution?
I think, you know, one of the things which people have to understand, and one of the things which I actually say in my article, is the fact that with the establishment of the theater commands, which will be over a period of time, not happened as yet, and the CDS coming into play, the power center, which is now concentrated under the Chief of Army Staff, who directly commands nearly 12 or 13 lakhs, nearly 14 lakh persons, that would actually get distributed into theater, under theater commanders. The power, therefore, will get distributed. This is actually has relevance to the fact that if you distribute power, then the ability of the military to bring its military power cohesively against the government, and that, when I'm talking about against the government or even staging a coup, is actually coup-proofing. When theater commands have better coup-proofing than the present system which we have. So that structural change which is going to be made is definitely going to be beneficial on that account. Whether this system, new one, with the creation of the DMA and so on and the CDS, whether this has, how it has performed in civil-military relations, I think it's too early to make an opinion, but there are warning signs which must not be ignored. Those warning signs are, and I say this in my article, even the habit now of most military leaders starting a public address with the reference to the Prime Minister, actually has the odor of pliancy in it. We should keep away from praising elected politicians, including the Prime Minister. You can do that personally or in private, but not in public spaces, because technically we serve the Commander-in-Chief, the Supreme Commander, which is the President. And therefore, I wouldn't like to pass judgment on the present set of leaders. But I think if we look at various statements which have come out from them, I think, in my view, there is a certain room for concern. I am not quite sure whether this is deliberate. What does it signify? But I would like to express my concern that in some of these statements which have been made over a period of time now should have been avoided. And I hope, and that can easily be done, they would avoid. Because one of the things about the military is that it's a highly hierarchical organization. That the example set by the people on top is finally what matters, and especially in the ethical domain. And the organization has the legal backing to enforce all this, and also it has a cultural tradition to enforce it. Legally, because the Army Act is very strict, can be used. And culturally, because from the time a person joins the academy or wherever it is drummed into everybody that we have an apolitical tradition, which is one of the greatest values which we must adhere to. So while we may have aberrations, we must always keep a watch and carry out corrections if we sense, if the leadership senses, that things have been done before which should not be done. As long as the lesson is learned, I think the military, Indian military, has the capacity to rectify itself, even if we make a fault.
Yeah. But you also have expressed concern that, you know, that there is a jury that is still out on how the increased presence of the military in the Ministry of Defense will impact its apolitical culture. So if by chance the defense minister tomorrow is, say, an army person, how can they preserve a balance between politics and military affairs? Because it may indicate that the mixing of politics and military is now something that is normalized, and this could be dangerous for democracies all over the world, India being one of the biggest democracies in the world. So how could this play out if it happened?
Right. Firstly, I'm not advocating for a moment that a person in uniform becomes the defense minister. That is not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is somebody with a military background could also become the defense minister. And I'm taking this argument, and the driver of this argument is because the present Indian geopolitical context is such that we have to carry out reforms at a time when threats are increasing. This is a particular phase in India's history. And in this phase, we should not rule out that we have a military person chosen by the Prime Minister who's got impeccable ethical credentials and professional credentials. Both of these are required. And therefore, if he has ethical credentials, then I think we don't have to worry about the close proximity problem between the uniformed and the defense minister who has a military background. Of course, there is nothing which is without risk. But don't forget, a defense minister who steps out of line can be removed anytime by the prime minister. More easier to shift out the chief of army staff than shifting out the chief of army staff. Of course, he can also be sacked. But a political change is much easier to do and has always been done. So what I had suggested was that we are probably in a situation now where defense reforms and geopolitical threats require a person with a military background. And I had said in my previous article that there are many countries in the world. I mean, all the major countries in the world, USA, Russia, China, UK, all have defense ministers now with military background. Quite understandably, I would say, because there is a global geopolitical flux. And for us, there is not only a global geopolitical flux that is directly impacting us, we are trying to carry out defense reform at this concurrently. This is the combination which requires somebody with a military background. I'm saying that this is only a temporary move to alleviate the problems which comes when you have only a civilian who's a full-time professional politician as a defense minister. I'm saying that a certain degree of military expertise is required, and it'll only do us good. But the risk, and I talk about the risk of politicization, is always there. And that's for the prime minister, who can actually oversee, handle it, and so on. But I think it's a risk which is worth taking. But I would say only as a temporary measure.
Yeah. But with this looming doubt and the questions arising that there could be increased civilian control of the military for their own interests, what do you think? Do you think this affects the credibility of the military institution today?
I think, you know, we must understand that politicians and political parties have their interests. They will always try to use whatever is within their power to get things done. And that is the nature of human affairs itself. Whether they can use the military without any resistance from the military, and military simply plays along because they believe these are orders, that is what I am questioning. That is the job of the senior leadership, to make that judgment. Are we being misused? Should we allow this to happen? But even then, when it happens, how do we deal with it? Do we make a public statement? No. I'm saying all these things have to be dealt with one-to-one between the politician and the military leadership, if necessary. If it has to be made public, then it has to be only through a resignation.
Yes. So thank you, General Menon, for answering all these important questions today and for this really interesting conversation, because I think now more than ever, we need to keep a check on balances of power between all these among all these institutions. So, I just want to say thank you for joining me again.
Thank you, Amira. Thank you very much.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week: Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.